This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're travelling back in time over three millennia to explore the makers, materials and remarkable innovations of ancient Egypt and the skills that shaped one of the most iconic civilizations in human history. You can send us your emails to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. Inspired by the major new exhibition, Made in Ancient Egypt, at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, tonight's show uncovers the hidden stories behind Egypt's most extraordinary objects, from the pyramids to the linens and textiles used by ordinary Egyptians. Tonight we'll find out about mummies and animal mummies and bring you into the ancient workshops themselves to see the makers at work, the men and women whose hands shaped the civilization we think we know, but rarely stop to consider. And so to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Helen Strudwick is the senior curator at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge and is the lead curator of the Made in Ancient Egypt exhibition. Professor Joyce Tilsley is professor of Egyptology at the University of Manchester, a leading public-facing Egyptologist whose work ranges from distance learning programs to award-winning books. She's written widely on Egyptian history, women in ancient Egypt, and the technologies that shaped everyday life, and her books include Cleopatra, Last Queen of Egypt, and The Pharaohs. Well, you're both very welcome, and later in the show I'll be joined by Professor Salima Ikram, Distinguished University Professor of Egyptology at the American University in Cairo and a leading expert on funeral archaeology, daily life and ancient craft practices. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And Helen, we might begin with you. First of all, to say congratulations for putting together this incredible exhibition, and then maybe to tell us how people have been engaging with it and what is it about ancient Egypt that still continues to excite us?
It's one of those things that we know very well as Egyptologists and people who work in museums particularly, that people are fascinated by our Egyptian galleries and spend a lot of time in there, both as children and as adults. And for whatever reason, it's kind of something that really captures people's imagination. And when you talk to them, as we do a lot, you find out that to some extent it's the kind of mystery of things, because the gods are a bit alien looking. Some of them have animal heads, and the whole concept of the afterlife is very appealing as well to some people. The kings of Egypt are quite famous. We know, of course, particularly about Tutankhamun. And it's that attraction kind of comes often through that route. But when they come to see this exhibition, that is absolutely absent, really. So, in fact, when they engage with reading the labels and things like that, we don't really talk about the kings of Egypt or very much about Egyptian religion. We're absolutely focusing here on the people who've been working on these things and showing small details that indicate the way they've worked and perhaps the reason why they've worked in the particular way. So it's a very different take, and the response has been phenomenal. And to an extent, that was what I expected it to be, because we've done a lot of outreach work with people based on our research on Egyptian coffins, where we've gone out into the community and then shown them some Egyptian objects, but focusing on the way they worked. And there's always a point in a conversation where people go, oh, they're just like us. And at that moment, I always feel that people's connection with ancient Egypt has changed somewhat. And that's what we're trying to get through in this exhibition. And it seems to be working. The response is amazing.
Joyce, when we think of ancient Egypt, we tend to think of the finished products, and we think of the tombs, and we think of the pyramids, and all of these things that are so iconic in our culture and in our popular culture. But we don't really think about how they were made and the people involved in the design and the creation and the construction of all of these things.
No, we tend to lose touch, I think, with the ordinary people who are actually making all these artifacts. And we look at the big scale. So as you say, we look at the pyramids, we look at Tutankhamun's death mask, and we're really impressed. But we don't tend to go that stage further and see, actually, how were these things made? And in some ways, it's because of the way that Egypt has been presented in the past, that to just focus on these big scale things. But when you really start to look at artifacts and see how they've been made and consider the people who made them, it's exactly as Helen has said, they're just like us. And we can learn so much for looking at the technology of ancient Egypt. And it really introduces the ordinary people who are otherwise hidden to us.
And Joyce, one of the interesting things is that we see the important role of women, and women are often left out of the story.
They are. That's because we rely, I think, too much on the official line that we see on tomb walls and in official writings, which is presenting a sort of propaganda of an ideal Egypt, which suggests that women don't do very much. They support their husbands, they run the homes, but they don't really do anything to contribute to the building of society, if you like. But of course, if we start to look at the archaeology and look at the artifacts, we can see that this is just not the case. The textile industry in ancient Egypt is a really good example of this. We know that women were employed making textiles, and they weren't just employed going out to work. They were working on textiles in the houses as a cottage industry as well. Fantastically important to them. And yet, we don't think of this. We just look at Egypt. We see that there's a great demand for linen, not just in clothes, but mummification in particular. And yet, we completely overlook that aspect of life. And it takes an exhibition to bring these things to our attention. And then we start to think, oh, yes, actually, this is how it works. And we could get a much more rounded view of Egyptian society.
And Helen, that is something that does come across very well in the catalogue. I've been working my way through it, and the remarkable things that are on display and the remarkable things you've put together. But it really shows how crucial women were in this story.
They absolutely were. And as Joyce has just said, we tend to so much overlook them. But they were absolutely foundational. I mean, you know, the poorest person wore some kind of fabric garment, and there have been textiles in people's houses. And we can see that all the way up to the top, you know, the king was wearing fine linen garments, things like that. These people who are producing these linen items are incredible. And when we see things like the letter from the woman who's writing to her boss saying, you know, these people are not going to be up to the job of producing the goods that you want, and complaining about them, you get a sense of somebody who's in charge of a work group there. So women are traditionally thought of, if they're ever thought of, as being in a subservient role. But here she's clearly in charge of this workshop, and has, you know, has got views and possibly is even able to write. So, you know, it gives us a whole different perspective on women at work in Egypt.
And there's some wonderful titles, Supervisor of Weavers, and then there's some artifacts as well, which shows women in these workshops spinning thread and the spinning bowl. So they're represented both in terms of the artifacts and indeed in terms of the titles.
Yeah, absolutely. And whenever possible, make a point of saying the name of that particular woman, Ear, because, you know, these people's names need to be spoken. And the Egyptians believed that when you spoke, your name was spoken, you came back to life. And I feel very strongly that we need to, especially with women, say their names so that they get a bit of a shout out. So that's, to me, very important aspect.
One thing that really interested me was the representation and the appearance of pregnant women and various things designed to almost maybe perhaps give protection or a blessing to women who were expecting a baby. And then some of these vessels, you had a vase showing pregnant women and women carrying children, and that childbirth and all of that seems to be a very important part of their work as well.
Yes, it was, but it was also a very dangerous thing. A lot of people died in childbirth. It seems to have been the principal form of early mortality for women in Egypt. So it was a precarious moment, childbirth, but very important, obviously, for the continuation of the lines of both the kings and people, you know, in working in different areas lower down the food chain, as it were. So it was essential that for the Egyptians that they produced you know, their children, that they were going to follow them, especially in trade. It was the children that seemed to follow their parents, fathers, often into the workshop, learnt from a very early age. We can see, for example, one of the vessels that we think was probably used to contain a liquid, a juice from the mandrake plant that might have been used for pain relief in childbirth. That was made by combining different shapes and elements of ceramic to create an extraordinary little vase. But the holes that join the bits together are tiny, as if they've been made, and they clearly look like fingers being poked through. But those fingers are very, very small. So it's likely that there were small young people working in the workshop that produced this very fine object. And they were doing that particular job to make that hole, or that set of holes in that object, to get it all to join together.
And Joyce, there's a whole hidden textile economy that we see here, where women are crucially involved as producers and in this whole endeavour.
Yes, it's not particularly hidden, actually. It's there. It's just that we haven't really paid any attention to it. If we look for the evidence, we can see it, but it needs something to bring it to our attention. And it's also, it's not just women, as Helena said, children as well. We can't really imagine that the children of ancient Egypt had the same sort of childhood that our children have. It seems likely that they would be put to work as soon as they could do something to help their parents or help, you know, be trained, if they're a boy, maybe trained in the profession that their fathers and uncles had. But the girls would be working as well. So this is another aspect of ancient Egyptian life that we just don't see, and yet it is there if we look for it.
And what about the idea of how should we view textiles when we look at these, everything from coarse garments to elite mummy wrappings, that in a way they're kind of part of the technology of the time?
They are, and they're very important. Recent work done by Egyptologists, including Christina Riggs, has demonstrated that the wrappings themselves are important. Unfortunately, quite often early Egyptologists would find something wrapped up and were just in linen, and would just throw away the wrappings and would keep whatever was inside. But to the ancient Egyptians, the act of wrapping and enclosing and using the linen to do this was also important. So it has an importance because it is clothing and it is something that is very practical, but it also can have a religious significance as well. And again, it's something that is obvious when you see it, but it's something that's been overlooked for a very long time.
And some of these letters and some of these documents tell us about everyday work, and we find out about what instructions they were given, what notes were made kind of in terms of the design, and even complaints that the people involved might have made.
Yes, yes. We don't have as many letters as we would like, obviously. It's quite rare that they survive. But what we have shows us just how like us they are, and we have all sorts of information about workers, not just in the textile trade, but we have information about workers in the Valley of the Kings and so on. And we can see the excuses they give for not turning up for work. And we can see when they're allowed time off work to do celebrations or for funerals and things. It's really important, I think, that we study this sort of material and don't just confine ourselves to looking at the historical kings and the traditional history of Egypt, but to really look at the background information as well, because these are the people who are actually building Egypt. Without the people working in textiles and without rope, which is a form of textiles, and basketry, they wouldn't have been able to build the pyramids. So these are really important aspects of life.
And Ear was given a task to complete an order of Linen Helen, but she complained that the people that she'd been given to supervise couldn't weave, and so there was all these challenges in trying to bring the order to completion.
Yeah, this seems to have been quite a regular complaint from people. You see that often in other situations, that people haven't been given the right tools and they're complaining. These documents are so lively and vivid. You can just imagine yourself there and, you know, hearing people discussing things and complaining about them. The voices of these people are so important. And what we've been able to do also is create some soundscapes within the spaces that kind of contextualise the different working areas. So the textile area is close to the woodworking area. And we've got a soundscape there which kind of indicates that this would have been within an area where people lived. So, we've got the sounds of dogs barking, donkeys braying, and also birdsong, because this would be within the cultivated area. So we try and it's very subtle, but we try and give people a sense, subliminally, really, that this was kind of within the area where people lived. And I think people really actually get that when they go into it, even if it's not something they absolutely register. Our gallery staff have been commenting on how much people are enjoying the sounds.
And Helen, I love in your introduction to the catalogue, you talk about how this exhibition is looking at the methods and it's looking at the materials and it's getting away from the images that come to mind of perhaps pyramids rising from the desert sands or these imposing stone statues. But do you think there's a whole mythology around ancient Egypt that perhaps is a little unhelpful as well, that so much has been shaped by popular culture and by movies and by these kind of fictional representations of ancient Egypt, and that perhaps distorts how we view this entire period?
I think that's a really valid point. I mean, one of the classic things is that, you know, the pyramids were built by slaves. And people talk about that as if that's a kind of a given. And when we look at how you build a huge structure like that, it requires people with real deep understanding of civil engineering, people who are providing precise pieces of stone that are needed. This is an incredible administrative undertaking. There is a lot more subtlety to it than just the kind of idea of people being lashed and dragging stones and then just dumping them and then up goes the pyramid. It is, you know, hugely planned. And we see that in every part, really, of Egyptian creation, that there is a lot of planning. There's a lot of detailed administration to make sure things work properly if it's at the state level. As Joyce mentioned, that we have a lot of evidence from the workers who worked in the Valley of the Kings, creating tombs there. And those records are absolutely invaluable for the detail that they give us of the planning of things, the organisation, you know, lists of people who showed up to work, as Joyce said, you know, that they could give excuses for not coming. And this would affect their pay. And so it was really vital that these things were noted carefully. And you were also talking about, you know, sort of seeing things from a different point of view, the way that these people worked. We get also these comments by scribes. There's a text known as the Teachings of Cheti, also called the Satire of the Trades, where scribes, who are the literate part of society, are saying, you know, the jobs of these people are terrible. You don't want to be doing that job. We're very lucky as we are. The purpose of that text, we're still debating, but it could be that it was just kind of a jokey text made for the amusement of each other. It could have been a kind of cautionary tale for young scribes to say, you know, you don't want to not do your work and end up being a terrible potter, you know, having to wallow around in the mud. So, you know, these texts are written by literate people who really manage very complex situations
And Helen, I almost fell into that trap, and I was going to ask you about all of these things that that are part of that popular imagery. But then I was going through the catalogue and I saw that slave and slaves don't appear at all in it. And I wondered, was there a role? I'm trying to work out, was there an element where slavery was part of the workforce, or is that again just something that that is part of a mythology?
Yeah, to me, it really is very much part of the mythology. I mean, it's clear that the stone quarries, going off the stone quarries was not a great thing to do. Some texts imply there were these enormous bands of people who were sent off into the quarries to go and collect stone. Now, some of those people may have been prisoners. I think there's some evidence to indicate that you could be sent to the quarries if you were a criminal, but no, there would have to be people who really knew what they were doing in organising that kind of stuff and getting it back to the Nile Valley. So the evidence for slave working in this area is really pretty much non-existent in, as far as I can tell. I'm happy if Joyce knows more about that than I do, but it just doesn't feature in anything that I've come across.
Yeah, Joyce, it is fascinating because, again, we tend to think of them as just these almost monuments to the egos of the pharaohs. But in fact, they seem to have had a wider and a bigger significance because they helped hold Egypt together. They showed what Egypt could achieve, that there were, as much it seems, demonstrations of planning and organisation and kind of almost like the vision of Egypt as well.
Yes, exactly. You can't build pyramids without a huge amount of organisation, as we've said. And you've got to have a lot of technology behind it as well. So you need boats to be able to sail up and down the Nile. You need ropes, you need charcoal. There's all sorts of technologies and tools. It's not just the obvious things that you need. And all these, as you say, you can't do it until you reach that level of development. But you also need a really good civil service or administration to run the whole thing. So it's a moot point whether the pyramids built Egypt, Egypt built the pyramids. You know, the two go hand in hand. It's been often been compared to something like Amish barn raising, where the community comes together and builds something for the community. Similar sort of thing. But by building the pyramids, Egypt itself developed as a land, and certainly the civil service developed as well. Because the Egyptians were almost unstoppable bureaucrats. They wrote down pretty much everything they possibly could, which is very helpful to us, obviously. But this wouldn't have happened unless there was a need for it.
Well, tonight we are talking history and we are talking about ancient Egypt. And we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we go excavating ancient Egypt. So stay with us here on News Talk.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the making of ancient Egypt. And I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Salima Ikram, Distinguished University Professor and Egyptology Unit Head at the American University in Cairo. She's worked as an archaeologist in Turkey, Sudan, Greece and the United States. And her books include Divine Creatures, as well as The Mummy in Ancient Egypt, The Tomb in Ancient Egypt, and Death and Burial in Ancient Egypt. Well, Salima, you're very welcome to the show. And I'd love to ask you maybe, first of all, about death and burial and about, I suppose, the amount of effort and work that went into the making of the coffins and the whole process involved in death and burial.
Yes. I mean, the Egyptians loved life a great deal, but they knew that that was a short-term thing. And so they invested heavily in death. And so a lot of their artisans and workers spent a lot of time crafting things for eternity.
And I'm intrigued to see how much detail and design went into things like the coffins and painting them and the intricate designs and layouts that clearly a lot of thought, but also a huge amount of effort went into all of this.
Oh, absolutely. I think that there must have been, you know, training places and lots of complicated systems set up within workshops so that people learn to do each job. One's not sure about how much they knew exactly about the iconography, the symbolism that was involved, but you had people who were working on carving. And with woodwork, it's particularly tricky because at certain times, the Egyptians didn't have that much in the way of forest. So they got to be very clever at putting together large things by using lots of small pieces of wood and turning them into a bit of a 3D puzzle. So you have the creation of the coffins, layers of textile being put on them, as well as plaster, and then finally painting the whole thing, which took hours and hours of meticulous work.
And do we know anything about the workshops, the great workshops that were creating so many of the sculptures and designing the royal images? And do we have any surviving guidelines or unfinished pieces that might perhaps show us what process was involved?
These are indeed some of the most exciting things that we find. There are, of course, things in the workman's village, which was a village called Deir el-Medina now. And it was where the people who made things, including the tombs for the kings, used to live. And it's on the west bank of modern-day Luxor. And so we have a lot of texts from there, as well as objects, tools, unfinished fragments of things, which all give us little clues as to what the process was like. And also a lot about the people who were actually making them.
And how much freedom did the sculptors have to go off in their own creative directions? Or were they working to grids and guidelines and proportions?
It was very much to grids and guidelines and proportions. Because what we call art is not really art for the ancient Egyptians. Everything had a very distinct purpose. And so they were really creating for eternity and using basically what they considered divine rules. And so that is why they sort of informal things stuck to one kind of one basic mode of expression. But you can see that the artists were very talented because in their sketches on ostracon, which are just little pieces of pottery or stone that they were using as almost like post-it notes, they made sketches that showed their versatility. So they could do things in three-quarters view. They knew about perspective. But they stuck to these guidelines because, of course, when you are making for eternity, it's sort of a divine thing. And that's why they obeyed the rules for the most part.
When we study the leaders, the pharaohs and the rulers, we get one sense of the civilization. But when we study the woodworking and the coffins and the papyri and the great sculptures and designs, we get a very different insight into the civilization and to just how advanced and just how sophisticated it was.
Indeed. I mean, you can see that it was, I suppose even now, when if you were looking at high art in the Renaissance, you would get one view of the world. And then you start actually looking at the people who were making it, who had a very different kind of existence. It is a similar kind of analogy one could draw for ancient times as one could for the Renaissance and even until relatively recently into the 19th century. But you can see that there was a very rich culture. And there was also the same system of patronage from kings looking after their workers and also noblemen saying, oh, you're very good at this. You can come and join my household and make all of my stuff. It looks much better than Mr. Next Door's stuff.
Now, Salima, you are the world's leading expert when it comes to animal mummies. And I was not aware really of animal mummies, except perhaps some images that you might see alongside a human mummy. But how significant were the animal mummies? How many were there? And what exactly was involved? And why were they preserved?
We have millions and millions of animal mummies, and you have them made for different purposes. Some were pets. Others were divine creatures that have been sort of regarded as the manifestations of the gods on earth. And when they died, they had been mummified. And the majority of animal mummies that we have are offerings that were given by pilgrims in, you know, as basically as a prayer, the same way that you light a candle in the church was buying an animal mummy and offering it to the gods. And what is particularly lovely about them is you get some very elaborate coffins for these mummies, as well as bandaging patterns. So you think of all the skill and artistry that was involved in concocting the wrappings and the trappings for these animal mummies, sometimes as much, if not more so, than for the humans.
And again, in the way the designs were made, and even in terms of the materials used, you get a great insight into the workers and the level of care and attention and the incredible craftsmanship as well.
What is also very nice is when I was looking at a group of mummies, in fact, these were humans, but you could identify the worker who had made them because they were the same kinds of knots that were made to lengthen the bandages that were wound around the body. So you start seeing little hallmarks, almost like when you see a painter, you can see the brushstroke of a particular individual. But you could even see in mummification particular hands that made a mummy. And so 3 mummies later, you can say, oh, I think that's the same person.
And I loved in your book, Divine Creatures, about the animal mummies, you were able to show how by studying these animals, we get to learn about the climate. We learn about veterinary practices, we learn about human nutrition, as well as the mummification technology. So it's a way of really opening up so much of the civilization to us.
Absolutely. I mean, I really feel that that is a window through which you walk, and then you can find out so much more than just about religious beliefs, but also about technology, trade, views about animals, gods, and of course, the changing climate, which is something that is very vexing even today.
Well, my thanks to Professor Salima Ikram, Distinguished University Professor and Egyptology Unit Head at the American University in Cairo, for joining us tonight to talk about the making of ancient Egypt. Helen, let's talk about some of the paintings then in the tombs, because there are some wonderful examples and you really get an insight into the culture and into the creative arts at that time.
Yeah, we're very lucky with these tomb paintings that are so informative. Well, what we haven't been able to do, obviously, is bring an entire tomb to Egypt. And we've relied very much on copies made by a very gifted pair of artists, in particular Nina Davis and her husband Norman, who were superb at copying these things. So we've got recreations of those. And we've actually, just to say, we've got these at very large scale in the gallery so that we feel like the people themselves are actually there, you know, almost at full size. So it's really another way of bringing the people into the exhibition. But those are so informative. They show all sorts of different processes going on, people working different ways, people collecting materials as well. What we do have to bear in mind are two things. One is that the people who were doing these, who were creating these wall paintings, were not the workers themselves. And so sometimes, not always, their interpretations of what people are doing may be slightly flawed. We shouldn't take them as literal gospel, what we're seeing. The other thing is we have to understand the purpose for which these illustrations were made. They weren't there to kind of create a kind of, this is how you do it, manual. Which is, you know, a risky thing that one can kind of get into one's head into. But they were there to produce images that showed the importance of the person for whom the tomb was made and showed, in a sense, that importance continuing into the afterlife. Or also it could show the people actually producing stuff for that person in the afterlife to keep them provided with the materials and things and food in particular that they needed to go forward into the afterlife. So we have to have 2 caveats around that when we talk about these things. They're not absolutely recording for all posterity how you do something. They serve a different purpose.
And Joyce, when we look at art, are we getting a kind of a window into everyday life, or is it something that is about symbolism and realism, or how, I suppose, should we consider interpreting it?
Yes, it's a really important question, that one. It's really easy to fall into the trap of looking at tomb walls and thinking, oh, this is like a photograph of the past, so this is how it was. people walk around in gleaming white clothes and everyone looks fairly happy with what they were doing, and we can see all the processes that are going on around them. We have to remember that these are not really daily life scenes. They are in the depicting things that occurred in daily life, but they're also to help the dead person in the afterlife. So that, as Helena said, they will show processes that lead to making certain artifacts, but not every artifact that is made in ancient Egypt is shown on a tomb wall, and they don't show every stage of making every artifact. And the workers might not be posed in the way they would have been doing it. You know, they're shown according to the artistic conventions as well. So there are lots of things that we have to remember. We're not just looking through a photograph album. There's a purpose to this, because, of course, the tomb is the place where the body would hopefully last for eternity, and that body would magically come to life after the funeral. The tomb walls would help this process, and the person would then live forever. As Helen said, it's important that we say the names of these people because it will help them to continue with their afterlife. But the art itself, we should be cautious with, but we should also really, first of all, enjoy looking at it, recognize that it gives us a view of ancient Egypt, but also recognize that it's not telling us the full story, it's telling us a partial story.
And in terms of the portrayals, do we see different artistic choices for powerful queens as distinct from the way kings are represented?
Well, we don't have that many tombs for powerful queens. If you mean queens who actually ruled Egypt as female kings, then there are only really four women who did that anyway. When we tend to see queens represented, we see a standard stock set of pictures on the tomb walls, and we don't see much about their family lives or anything. When women are included in tombs with their husbands, then we see far more about his life, and the woman is always relegated to a sort of supportive background role, a passive role. It's very misleading. It's not that life was like that, but on the whole, the tomb tends to be the tomb of the tomb owner, who is male, and the woman who is with him, his wife, is important, but she's clearly not as important as him. So we can get a very misguided view of what's going on in Egypt then. You know, it's easy to, again, look at the elite tombs, not necessarily queens, but sort of nobles, and see a man and a wife standing smaller scale behind him and think, oh, she really does nothing. She's just there to have the children. And then we look again at the evidence that there is for artifacts, and we think, but she still might be doing weaving and so on. She's running a home. She might be able to read and write. We've assumed that she can't, but why have we assumed this? There's all sorts of questions that come from looking at this art, which is what makes ancient Egypt such a fascinating subject to study, I think, that we can always think of more questions and look for new answers.
And Helen, here in Ireland, we have the Book of Kells, and people love visiting that and seeing how the artwork, the incredible creation was made, and the pigments, and how they were able to create these colours and illuminate it so beautifully. But it, again, with this exhibition, you see the exact same thing. You see the creation of the pigment Egyptian blue. You see the way they designed the colours and the incredible attention to detail. And it just, even though thousands of miles apart and very different, it struck me as having a similarity in the way you're getting these insights into creation and the creative process, as well as what was actually created.
I think that's absolutely right. We're noticing now also in the museum, we're approaching our own manuscript collection in a way of looking at the way the things were made. One of the problems with things like manuscripts and books, when they are in a museum, they're kind of locked within a cabinet and people can't do the thing you're most meant to do with them, which is to handle them. So we're trying to kind of help people to imagine what it'd be like, or actually have examples of the material so people can actually feel them. And that's, I think, so important, that this engagement that people get when they're actually looking at these things, where they can actually relate to the creative process. And when we are looking, for example, at the use of pigments, it's very easy to just go, oh yes, it's blue, or it's green, or whatever, without thinking, but hang on, how was that made? And how has this artist actually used it? So there's a kind of given thing that we understand from ancient Egyptian art, which is that on the whole, artists were using colours in a kind of, this is a yellow area, this is a blue area,
this is a green area, a bit like sort of painting by numbers. We have a papyrus that on display, which is a wonderful example of a series of spells made for a man called Ramose, who is actually in charge of a group of scribes. And the individual little illustrations for the spells that are in there are painted by one or more artists who completely buck that trend. They use colours in the most subtle way to indicate the musculature of people. There's a wonderful heron that we've got on display at the moment in the one part of this manuscript, papyrus, I should call it, where we can see that the artist has tried to create shadow under the wing of the heron and used sort of subtlety of colour to give us a round shape of this bird. It is extraordinary, and it really isn't that common, but it does show that it did happen, and that we shouldn't kind of see these just sort of blanket rules that we tend to apply to Egyptian art. Honestly, it's just a wonderful thing in the display. I should just point out, though, to your listeners that supposing that they come in the next few weeks, we're having to change the papyrus part that we're showing on a sort of two-monthly basis because it cannot take very much light because the pigments are so fragile. And so we are going to have a different set of parts of the papyrus from the beginning of December onwards. So they won't see the heron, I'm afraid. But if you come before, you can see it.
Very good. And also what really intrigued me is that there's a difference between how the scientific analysis and the advanced imaging has considered how things would look and how it really looks when people have experimented practically. So in other words, the computer imaging might say, oh, it was looking like this or done like this. But then when people actually recreated it, it actually turns out a little bit different.
Oh, that's very interesting, and it's the kind of thing where you cannot imagine that, you know, that the science is telling you one thing and then you're seeing something different going on. You have to kind of reach a meeting of minds because the science is on the whole not absolutely wrong, but you know, there's this kind of moment where you think, yes, but when we look at what's actually going on, we're seeing something different, and it's often because there's a layer that isn't actually visible and it's kind of throwing out the results. We don't need to kind of see it because we can't actually see it. And so that is an interesting point. But the science is so helpful, though, also in us understanding the materials that we see. I mean, without those, it's really difficult to distinguish the different colours of white, for example, that the Egyptians were using in this particular papyrus. There's all sorts of different colours that using or pigments used to create this colour white. In particular, there is this very bright, bright white that's used to show the kind of folds in the linen clothing, done in a very clever way. And we always refer to this one as a kind of Dulux gloss white that goes over the top to make this amazing effect of the pleats. But the layers of paint are so thin. It's unbelievable how this person did this with so little paint to create incredible different textures and results. But it is down to the science that we can detect those. So the science is both useful and at times it's confusing.
And Helen, about 10 years ago, 9 years ago, the Fitzwilliam Museum hosted the Coffins Workshop. And it was an event where people were able to study how the coffins were made, but get experience of using replica tools to cut the wood and to prepare them and decorate and create them in the style of the ancient Egyptians. And it's incredible when people are able to do that because you get a much better sense by doing it than you ever would from reading about it.
It's absolutely true. I mean, when you actually start having a go at working with these tools, you realise both the skill of the people who did these things, but also you recognise the marks that are made by these tools when you're looking at objects under close observation or using raking light or even under a microscope. I will say also that workshop, which was brilliantly arranged by my most close working colleague, Julie Dawson, we invited quite a few Egyptian colleagues to come over and take part in that. And one of them said to me afterwards that it changed his life. And he works at the new Gem Museum in Cairo, and which was innovative in so many ways, in the fact, though, that they created the conservation centre before they actually created the museum to prepare the objects to go into that museum. And he has led the charge in looking after the wooden objects that were from the tomb of Tutankhamun that are now displayed in that display area now in the Gem. But that he said that he couldn't have done that without he could have done it, of course, but he had far more insights because of the coffin workshop that we did.
Well, tonight we are talking about the making of ancient Egypt and the incredible people who are involved in all of that. And we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out about new ways to explore how we should understand ancient Egypt. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the making of ancient Egypt, inspired by a wonderful exhibition in the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. And I'm rejoined by Professor Joyce Tilsley, who's Professor of Egyptology at the University of Manchester, and also Helen Strudwick, who's the lead creator of that Made in Ancient Egypt exhibition at Cambridge. And Joyce, I wanted to talk to you about maybe how we should approach thinking or rethinking about ancient Egypt, because it seems to me that I think there's a certain prejudice that we have, that we think that our age is the most civilized one and has had the greatest advances, and that people in earlier times and ancient times were kind of almost, you know, uncivilized or closer to savagery. But yet the more I read about ancient Egypt, I'm reading about mass production and metal workers and Egyptian jewelers and linen and basketry and woodwork and the makers of papyri and glass and all of the incredible design and details. It's such a sophisticated culture, and it's so incredibly rich and detailed that it shows that a certain prejudice that we might have is completely wrong.
Yes, indeed. And one of the interesting things is that many of these techniques developed really early on in Egyptian history, and they just continue pretty much once they've perfected it. They just carry on with the same way of doing things. They do it over and over again because they know they've reached perfection, and they have no interest in really burying it too much. I think this has happened for several reasons. There's the idea that ancient Egypt is sort of slightly separate from us, that we mentioned earlier on, and is a sort of romantic, beautiful, but not necessarily real place. But there's also, we've had problems with the actual artifacts that have been recovered, because for a long time, Egyptologists were recovering artifacts from graves and tombs rather than from actual settlements and communities. And this is caused by the actual geography of Egypt, that you have the River Nile running through the center of Egypt, and then you have the cultivated land to either side of it where it's moist and you can grow things, and then you would have the settlements on the edge of that, and then in the desert you would have the tombs and the graves. And of course the tombs and the graves have survived over time much better than the settlements. So the early Egyptologists, who also needed to find things that they could pass on to the people who were funding their work, focused on the graves and the tombs because they knew that they would find artifacts, but they didn't focus on the settlements because they were few and far between and they're in much worse condition. So we sort of have this situation where we know quite a lot about death in ancient Egypt, and it gives us the impression that they are people focused on death, but far less information about daily life. But we do have some information, and we've just kind of overlooked it a bit. And if we looked at what we really have, as this exhibition does, then we do really start to see a whole different aspect. We see that they are these sophisticated people who are doing this sophisticated work. We know it because we've seen the results of their work in the tombs, but we've not put two and two together because we've been able to look at elite tomb owners and their goods, but we've not been able to look at the people who made those goods. It's there, but we haven't done it. So it's like a whole new ancient Egypt opening up to us.
So in a way, Joyce, we kind of get, we get inspired, our imagination is captured by things like the mummies and a sarcophagus and all of these iconic images. But then, and there are sarcophagi in the exhibition, and you see about the designs and the incredible work that went into all of this and the wrappings and everything. But that we learn that there's a lot more to it as well, and that there's a wider culture as well that goes beyond maybe the headline areas and icons.
Absolutely. The Egyptian people, I think, were not a people obsessed with death. They made sensible preparations for their own death, but they also enjoyed life. And of course, when we're looking at tombs and rich grave goods, we're looking at the very top percentage of the community. We're not looking at everyone by any means. Most people lived ordinary lives and were buried in a local cemetery. And I don't think in their daily life, we can see this from their writing. They're interested in gossip and they're interested in work and how the work is distributed and whether things are going right or wrong. They're not morbid people obsessed with death. But we've sort of picked up on this as well. We've been accustomed to looking at exhibitions that only deal with that aspect of life or primarily deal with that aspect. And we've just sort of omitted the other information, which really allows us to see the real Egypt, I think.
So, Joyce, if there was one message you would like our listeners to take away from tonight's show, what is it? How would you like to maybe reframe how we approach ancient Egypt?
It's to see the people of ancient Egypt as real people. As has been said, they're just like us in many ways. Obviously, they have different lives. They're not entirely just like us, but they have to. They sleep at night, they get up, they work, they eat, they drink. We shouldn't see them as some sort of romanticized people living an idealized life. They are people just like us. And that makes them, I think, more fascinating, not less.
So, Helen, if some of our listeners were to fly over to Stansted and get the new train, so they don't even need to get the bus and zoom their way to beautiful Cambridge, what would they see and what would be so exciting about getting this insight into the making of ancient Egypt?
The exhibition is split into different areas of working. So we start with stoneworking, working in relief, then working in the round to create sculptures, particularly king sculptures, because the workshops that we know most about are making royal statuary. We look at pottery, and then we move into a room where we're looking at hot working and the processes of creating a material known as faience and glass, and bronze making and gold working. And then we've got another section within that gallery where we pull some of those things together and see the way that jewellers were using the materials from these production lines into creating art, you know, works that could be worn by the elite on the whole. And then the final room is dealing with linen and woodworking and painting, and then we finally end up with working on coffins and looking at how, whereas we know a lot about coffin, why the concept of why coffins were made, etc., etc., we're looking very much at how they were made, but also the way that those very skilled workers in their own right were having to bring in materials like eyes made of glass or bronze rims for eye inlays. And you'd have to order those sorts of things and get them. And then throughout the exhibition, as well as wonderful objects that highlight the skill of these people who worked on these things, we see other examples where something may have gone wrong, unfinished objects which show us clues to how people were working. We show some tools. But we also have these little documents that record things like a delivery of cut wood, an order for a set of four wooden windows, and the person demanding these in quite a forthright way says, "This is a job to be done by tomorrow. Hurry, hurry!" You know, so you get this kind of you get the objects, you get the detail of seeing for yourself how things were made, but then you've also got the words of the people involved as well. And right at the end, we've got, in this coffin section, a receipt for making coffins and a receipt for decorating a coffin. So we can see that this work was recompensed in various ways by the people who were buying these things.
But the thing I was really moved by, actually, was when we had the exhibition opening, which is always a very kind of grand event, we had invited the ambassador from Egypt to come, and he came up to me at the end and he said, "I've never seen my country portrayed like this before." And he actually had tears in his eyes. And it was, you know, I felt very kind of humbled by the fact that we'd been able to do that. But I also, as I say, I kind of felt this awful guilt that as Egyptologists, we all know an awful lot about these people from reading these texts, but somehow we've never conveyed it properly somehow in an exhibition. Come and see it for yourselves, people, because there's so much to learn.
Helen, you've done such brilliant work bringing this to life, and the same with Joyce as well, two of the most passionate and interesting and incredible people on the subject of ancient Egypt. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you both. Helen Strudwick, who's the senior curator at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge and the lead curator of that wonderful new exhibition running until the 12th of April next year, 2026, Made in Ancient Egypt. And my thanks also to Professor Joyce Tilsley, Professor of Egyptology at the University of Manchester and a very deserved winner of this year's Archaeologist of the Year Award in the United Kingdom. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, for bringing everything together. Hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been talking history. Good night.